D'Artagnan related that Aramis, being wounded, had been obliged to stop at Crèvecœur, that he had left Athos fighting at Amiens, with four men who accused him of being a coiner, and that he himself had been compelled to run the Count de Wardes through the body in order to reach England. But there the confidence of D'Artagnan ended. He merely announced that, on his return from England, he had brought four splendid horses with him, one for himself and one for each of their companions, and he concluded by informing Porthos that the one destined for him was already in the stables of the hotel. At this moment Planchet entered. He intimated to his master that the horses were sufficiently refreshed, and that it would be possible to go to Clermont in time to pass the night there. As D'Artagnan was pretty well satisfied as to Porthos's state, and was anxious to gain some information concerning his two other friends, he gave his hand to the invalid, and told him that he should now proceed to continue his inquiries. And, as he expected to return by the same road, if Porthos in 7 or 8 days was still at the hotel of the Great St. Martin, he would take him up upon his way. Porthos answered that in all probability his sprain would confine him till that time, and, moreover, he must wait at Chantilly for a reply from the Duchess. D'Artagnan wished him a speedy and favourable one, and after having again commended him to the care of Mousqueton, and paid the landlord his own expenses, he once more took the road with Planchet, who was already relieved of one of the led horses. 26. The Thesis of Aramis. D'Artagnan had said nothing to Porthos, either about his wound or about the attorney's wife. Young as he was, Arbernese was very discreet. Consequently, he had pretended to believe everything that the boasting musketeer had told him, convinced that no friendship can support itself against a secret discovered, especially when that secret wounds the pride. Since one always has a certain moral superiority over those with whose frailties we are acquainted. In his plans for the future, resolved as he was to make his three friends the instruments of his success, D'Artagnan was not sorry to collect in his hand those invisible threads by the aid of which he meant to lead them. Nevertheless, throughout the whole of his journey, an overwhelming sadness hung upon his heart. He thought of that young and pretty Madame Bonancieux, who was to have bestowed upon him the reward of his devotion. Let us, however, at once declare that the young man's melancholy was not so much a regret for his own lost enjoyment as a dread that something unfortunate had befallen the missing woman. He had himself no doubt that she was a victim of the cardinal's vengeance, and it was well known that his eminence's revenge was always terrible. But how had he himself found pardon in the eyes of the minister? This was what he did not know. But what Monsieur de Cavois, the captain of the guard, would undoubtedly have communicated to him had he found him at home. Nothing passes the time or shortens the path like a thought which engrosses all the faculties of an individual's organization. Our external existence is as a sleep, of which this thought is the dream. And, whilst we are subjected to its influence, time has no longer any measure, nor is there any distance in space. We leave one place and arrive at another, and are conscious of nothing in between. Of the intervening scenes, the only remembrance preserved is somewhat akin to the idea of an indefinite mist, partially broken by obscure images of mountains, trees, and plains. It was under the dominion of this hallucination that D'Artagnan, at the pace that his horse pleased to take, passed over the 6 or 8 leagues which separated Chantilly from Crèvecœur, without having, on his arrival at the latter village, any recollection of the things he had encountered on the road. But their memory returned to him. He shook his head, perceived the tavern where he had left Aramis, and, putting his horse into a trot, reined in at the door. It was not a landlord this time, but a landlady who received him. D'Artagnan, being somewhat of a physiognomist, examined at a glance the fat and good-humoured face of the mistress of the place. This glance satisfied him that dissimulation was not necessary with her, and that he had nothing to fear from such a happy-looking countenance. "My good lady," demanded D'Artagnan, "can you tell me what has become of one of my friends, whom I was obliged to leave here about 12 days ago?"
A handsome young man of about 23 or 24 years of age, mild, amiable, and handsome?
Exactly so. And, moreover, wounded in the shoulder.
Just so. Well, he is still here.
Ah, my dear lady, said D'Artagnan, springing from his horse and throwing the bridle to Planchet. You give me life! Where is this dear Aramis? Let me embrace him, for I confess that I long to see him.
Pardon me, sir, but I question whether he can see you at present.
Why not? Is there a lady with him?
Oh, dear me, sir, what a question! Poor youth! No, sir, there is not a woman with him.
Who, then?
The curate of Montdidier and the superior of the Jesuits of Amiens.
Good God! Exclaimed D'Artagnan. Is the poor young man so very ill?
No, sir, quite the contrary. But towards the end of his illness, he has been touched by grace, and has determined on taking holy orders.
Ah, true, said D'Artagnan. I had forgotten that he was only a musketeer temporarily.
Do you still insist on seeing him, sir?
Oh, yes, more than ever.
Well, then, you have only to take the left-hand staircase in the courtyard to number 5 on the second floor.
D'Artagnan quickly followed this direction, and found one of those outside staircases which may still be sometimes seen in the courtyards of old-fashioned inns. But it was no such easy matter to get admission to the future abbé. The avenues of Aramis's chamber were as strictly guarded as the gardens of Armidus. Bazin was stationed in the corridor, and barred the passage against him with the more intrepidity as, after many years of trial, he saw himself at length on the eve of acquiring that distinction of which he had always been ambitious. In fact, the dream of poor Bazin had ever been to serve a churchman, and he impatiently expected the so long anticipated moment when Aramis would at last throw off his military uniform and adopt the cassock. It had only been by the daily reiteration of this promise that he had been included to continue in the service of the musketeer, in which, as he said, he could not fail to forfeit his salvation. Bazin was therefore at the very summit of happiness. There was every probability that his master would keep to his determination this time. The union of physical and moral pain had produced the effect so long desired. Aramis, suffering at once in mind and body, had at length fixed his thoughts and eyes upon religion, and he had regarded as a warning from heaven the double accident which had befallen him, that is to say, the sudden disappearance of his mistress and the wound in his shoulder. In such a mood, it may be easily imagined that nothing could have been more disagreeable to Bazin than the appearance of D'Artagnan, which might throw his master again into the whirlwind of those worldly ideas of which he had been so long the sport. He resolved, therefore, bravely to defend the door, and, as betrayed by the landlady, he could not say that Aramis was out, he attempted to prove to the newcomer that it would be the height of impropriety to interrupt the pious conversation which his master had maintained since morning, and which, as Bazin added, could not be concluded before night. But D'Artagnan paid no attention to the eloquent discourse of Bazin. Not wishing to enter into a polemical discussion with his friend's valet, he simply put him aside with one hand and turned the handle of the door of number 5 with the other. The door opened, and D'Artagnan entered the apartment. Aramis, in a long black coat, and with his head encased in a kind of round, flat cap, which was no bad representation of a skull-cap, was seated at a long table, covered with rolls of paper and enormous folios. On his right sat the superior of the Jesuits, and on his left the curate of Montdidier. The curtains were half closed, giving entrance only to a subdued, mysterious light, appropriate to holy meditation. All those worldly objects which are apt to greet the eye in the chamber of a young man, and particularly when that young man is a musketeer, had disappeared, as though by enchantment, and doubtless from a fear that the sight of them might recall his master's mundane inclinations, Bazin had laid hands upon the sword, the pistols, the plumed hat, and the embroidery and lace of every sort and kind. But instead of these, D'Artagnan fancied he saw, in an obscure corner, something like a cord of discipline hanging by a nail to the wall. At the noise which D'Artagnan made on entering, Aramis raised his head and recognized his friend. But, to the great surprise of the latter, this sight did not seem to produce much impression on the musketeer, so much was his mind detached from all terrestrial affairs.
"How are you, my dear D'Artagnan?" said Aramis. "Believe me, I am glad to see you."
"And I also," said D'Artagnan, "although I am not yet quite sure that it is Aramis I am speaking to."
The same, my friend. But what could make you doubt it?"
"I thought I had mistaken the room and entered the chamber of a churchman. And then another terror seized me when I found you in the company of these gentlemen. I feared you were dangerously ill." The two men in black launched a glance almost of menace at D'Artagnan, whose intention they perceived. But he did not on that account disturb himself. "Perhaps I inconvenience you, my dear Aramis," continued D'Artagnan, "for, from what I see, I am led to suppose that you are confessing to these gentlemen."
Aramis colored slightly. "Oh, no, on the contrary, my dear friend. And, as a proof of it, permit me to protest to you that I rejoice at seeing you safe and sound."
"Ah, he is coming to himself again," thought D'Artagnan. "This is fortunate."
"This gentleman, who is my friend, has just escaped a serious danger," continued Aramis, addressing the two ecclesiastics as he pointed to D'Artagnan with his hand.
"Praise God for it, sir," replied they, bowing their heads in concert. "I have not failed to do so, reverend fathers," replied the young man as he returned their salutation.
"You are come just in the nick of time, my dear D'Artagnan," continued Aramis, "and by taking part in our discussion, you will enlighten it by your ability. Monsieur the Principal of Amiens, Monsieur the Curate of Montdidier, and myself are arguing certain theological questions which have long interested us, and on which I shall be delighted to have your opinion."
"The opinion of a soldier has but little weight," replied D'Artagnan, who began to be uneasy at the turn things were taking. "You may rely upon the knowledge of these gentlemen." The men in black bowed.
"On the contrary," replied Aramis, "your opinion will be of great value. The question is this. The principal thinks that my thesis should be, above all things, dogmatic and didactic."
"Your thesis? Are you preparing a thesis?"
"Certainly," replied the Jesuit. "For the examination preceding ordination, a thesis is rigorously demanded."
"Ordination!" exclaimed D'Artagnan, who could scarcely believe what the landlady and Bazin had successively told him. "Ordination!" And his eyes wandered in astonishment over the three persons who were before him.
"Now," continued Aramis, disposing himself on his chair in the same graceful manner as he would have done in the stall of a cathedral, and complacently examining his hand, which was as white and plump as that of a lady, and which he held up to make the blood flow out of it. "Now, Monsieur D'Artagnan, as you have heard, the principal would have my thesis dogmatic, whilst I, for my own part, I think it ought to be idealistic. It is on this account that the principal has proposed to me the following subject, which has never yet been treated of, and in which I recognize matter susceptible of most magnificent developments. Utraque manus in benedicendo clericis inferioribus necessaria sit."
D'Artagnan, whose extent of erudition we are aware of, did not knit his brows at this citation, any more than at that which Monsieur de Treville had made to him on the occasion of the presents which he supposed D'Artagnan to have received from the Duke of Buckingham.
"Which means," resumed Aramis, in order to furnish him with every facility, "to the lower order of priests, both hands are indispensable when they give the benediction."
"Admirable and dogmatic," repeated the curate, whose knowledge of Latin was about equal to D'Artagnan's, and who carefully watched the Jesuit in order to keep pace with him and to reproduce his words like an echo. As for our young Gascon, he was profoundly indifferent to the enthusiasm of the two men in black.
"Yes, admirable. Prosus admirabile," continued Aramis. "Yet, demanding a deep investigation of the writings of the fathers and of the holy books, But I have owned to these learned ecclesiastics, and that in great humility, that the watches of the guards and the service of the king have made me to some extent negligent of study. I should therefore feel more at home, Facilius Natans, in some subject of my own selection, which would be, in relation to these difficult questions, what morals are to metaphysics in philosophy.
See what an exordium!
Exclaimed the Jesuit. D'Artagnan was thoroughly tired. So also was the curate.
Exordium! Repeated the curate, for the sake of saying something. Quem ad modum intercelorum immensitatem.
Aramis glanced at D'Artagnan, and saw that his friend was gaping in a way to dislocate his jaws.
Let us speak French, father, said he to the Jesuit. Monsieur D'Artagnan will more truly enjoy our discourse.
Yes, said D'Artagnan. I am fatigued by my journey, and all this Latin is beyond me.
Agreed,
said the Jesuit, somewhat piqued, whilst the delighted curate gave D'Artagnan a look of earnest gratitude.
Well, see the conclusion which might be drawn from this scholium. Moses, the servant of God, he is only the servant, do you observe? Moses blessed with the hands. He had his two arms held forth, whilst the Hebrews battled with their foes. Therefore, he blessed with the two hands. Besides, what says the gospel? Imposuite manus, and not manum. Lay on the hands, and not the hand.
Lay on the hands,
repeated the curate, performing at the same time the gesture.
To Saint Peter, again, of whom the popes are the successors,
continued the Jesuit.
Porige digitos, stretch out the fingers. Do you perceive now?
Certainly, said Aramis in great delight. But the point is subtle.
The fingers, resumed the Jesuit. Saint Peter blessed with the fingers. The Pope then blesses also with the fingers. And with how many fingers does he bless? With three fingers. One for the Father, one for the Son, and one for the Holy Ghost.
They all crossed themselves at these words, and D'Artagnan thought it a duty to imitate the example.
The Pope is the successor of Saint Peter, and he represents the three divine powers. The remainder, ordines inferiores, of the ecclesiastical hierarchy bless by the names of saints, archangels, and angels. The very humblest priests, such as our deacons and sacristans, bless with sprinklers, which simulate an indefinite number of blessing fingers. The subject is now simplified. Argumentum omni denudatum ornamento. I could expand it, continued the Jesuit, into two volumes of the size of this.
And in his enthusiasm he thumped the folio St. Chrysostom, which made the table bend beneath its weight. D'Artagnan trembled.
Assuredly, said Aramis, I render justice to the beauties of this thesis, but at the same time I feel that it would overwhelm me. I had chosen this text, tell me, dear D'Artagnan, if it is not to your taste, Non inutile est desiderium in oblatione. Or, still better, a small regret is not unbecoming in an offering to the Lord.
Stop there!
Vociferated the Jesuit.
For that thesis borders on heresy. There is a proposition almost identical in the Augustinus of the heresiarch Jansenius, for which, sooner or later, that book will be burned by the executioner's hands. Take care, my young friend. You incline towards false doctrines. You will go astray, my young friend.
You will go astray,
said the curate, shaking his head in great concern.
You are close upon the famous point of free will, which is a fatal stumbling block. You approach nearly the insinuations of the Pelagians and the semi-Pelagians.
"But, reverend sir," resumed Aramis, somewhat stunned by the storm of arguments which descended on his head.
"How will you prove,"
continued the Jesuit, without allowing him time to speak,
"that we ought to regret the world when we offer ourselves to God? Listen to this dilemma. God is God, and the world is the devil. Hence, to regret the world is to regret the devil. There is my reduction."
"It is mine also," said the curate.
"But pray," resumed Aramis,
"desideras diabolum, unhappy man," exclaimed the Jesuit.
"He regrets the devil. Ah, my young friend," resumed the curate with a groan, "do not regret the devil, I beseech you."
D'Artagnan was beginning to lose his wits. He seemed to be in a company of madmen, and to be in danger himself of becoming as mad as those he was listening to. Only he was necessitated to hold his tongue from not understanding the language in which they talked.
"But listen to me," interrupted Aramis with a degree of politeness under which some impatience began to be perceptible. "I do not say that I regret. No, I never will pronounce that phrase, which would be unorthodox."
The Jesuit raised his arms towards heaven, and the curate did the same.
"No, but admit at least that it would be unbecoming merely to offer to the Lord that with which we are entirely disgusted. Am I right, D'Artagnan?"
"Quite so, I think, mon Dieu," exclaimed the latter. The curate and the Jesuit started from their seats.
"Now, here is what I lay down. It is a syllogism. The world is not wanting in attractions. I quit the world. Therefore, I make a sacrifice. Now, Scripture says positively, 'Make a sacrifice unto the Lord.'"
"That is true," admitted the antagonists.
"Then," continued Aramis, pinching his ear to make it red, as he had before waved his hands to make them white, "then I have made a stanza upon this subject, which I showed last year to Monsieur Voiture, and on which that great man highly complimented me."
"A stanza!" exclaimed the Jesuit scornfully.
"A stanza!" responded the curate mechanically.
"Recite it, recite it," vociferated D'Artagnan. "That will be a little change."
"No change, for it is religious," replied Aramis. "It is theology in verse."
"The devil!" exclaimed D'Artagnan.
"Here it is," said Aramis, with a gentle air of modesty, which was not altogether exempt from hypocrisy. "All you who mourn past happiness now flown, and live through long and weary days of woe, your sorrows all a certain end shall know, when tears are offered to your God alone, by you who mourn below." D'Artagnan and the curate seemed pleased. The Jesuit persisted in his opinion.
"Be cautious of a profane taste in a theological style. What, in fact, does St. Augustine say? Severus sit clericorum sermo."
"Yes, let the sermon be clear," said the curate.
"But,"
hastily interrupted the Jesuit, on seeing his attendant blundering,
"but your thesis will please the ladies, and that is all. It will have the popularity of one of Maître Patrou's pleadings."
"God grant it," exclaimed Aramis, overjoyed.
"You say," resumed the Jesuit, "the world still speaks within you in a loud voice, altissima voce. You follow the world, my young friend, and I fear that grace will not prove efficacious."
"Doubt me not, reverend father, I answer for myself."
"Worldly presumption!"
"I know my own heart, father. My resolution is irrevocable."
"Then you persist in pursuing this thesis?"
"I feel myself called to treat that, and not any other one. I shall, therefore, continue it, and I trust that tomorrow you will be contented with the emendations which I shall have made in it, under your advice."
"Work slowly," said the curate. we leave you in excellent dispositions.
Yes, the ground is all sown, said the Jesuit, and we have no reason to fear that some part of the seed has fallen in stony places, and some upon the highway, and that the birds of the air have eaten up the remainder. Aves, Caeli, comederunt illam.
May the plague choke you with your Latin, exclaimed D'Artagnan, whose patience would hold out no longer.
Farewell, my son, said the curate. Farewell till tomorrow.
Adieu till tomorrow, rash youth, said the Jesuit. You promise to be one of the lights of the church. God grant that this light prove not a devouring flame.
D'Artagnan, who had been gnawing his nails with impatience for an hour, was beginning to reach the flesh. The two men in black bowed to Aramis and D'Artagnan and proceeded towards the door. Bazin, who had kept standing and had listened to this controversy with a pious jubilation, rushed towards them, seized the breviary of the curate and the missal of the priest, and walked respectfully before them to clear their path. Aramis himself conducted them to the bottom of the stairs and came up again to D'Artagnan, who was still deep in meditation. When they were left alone, the two friends at first maintained an embarrassed silence. Nevertheless, it was imperative that one of them should speak first, and D'Artagnan seemed determined to leave that honour to his friend.
"You see me," said Aramis, "return to my original ideas."
"Yes, as the gentleman said just now, efficacious grace has touched you."
"Oh, these plans of retirement have long been formed, and you, my friend, have often heard me speak of them, have you not?"
"Yes, certainly, but I confess that I always thought you were joking."
"What? About such things as these? Oh, D'Artagnan!"
"Why, we joke even in the face of death."
"And we are wrong to do so," said Aramis, "for death is the gate which leads to salvation or to condemnation."
"Agreed," said D'Artagnan. "But do not let us discuss theology. You must have had enough for the day. And as for me, I confess I have almost forgotten the little Latin that I ever knew. And besides, to tell the truth, I have eaten nothing since 10 o'clock this morning, and am as hungry as 20 devils.
"We will dine presently, my dear friend. Only you will remember that this is Wednesday, and on that day I can neither eat meat nor see any eaten. If you will be contented with my dinner, it is composed of boiled tetragones and fruit."
"What do you mean by tetragones?" anxiously inquired D'Artagnan.
"I mean spinach," replied Aramis. "But for you I will add some eggs, although it is a grave infraction of rule, eggs being certainly meat, since they produce chickens."
"This feast is not very nourishing, but never mind. To remain with you, I will submit to it."
"I am grateful to you for the sacrifice," replied Aramis. "But if it be not beneficial to your body, depend upon it, it will be so to your soul."
"So, Aramis, you decidedly entered the church? What will your friends say? What will Monsieur de Treville say? They will look upon you as a deserter, I forewarn you."
"I do not enter the church. I re-enter it. It was the church that I deserted for the world. For you are aware that I did violence to my inclinations in taking the uniform of a musketeer."
"I know nothing about it."
"Are you ignorant, then, of my reasons for quitting the seminary?"
"Entirely so."
"Then listen to my history. Besides, the scriptures say, confess yourselves to one another, and I shall confess to you, D'Artagnan."
"And I give you absolution beforehand. You know that I am a good-hearted fellow."
"Do not jest with sacred things, my friend."
"Go on, then. I am listening."
"I had been at the seminary from the age of 9 years until I was 21. In 3 days more I was to be an abbé, and all would have been over. One evening, when I went, according to my custom, to a house which I frequented with pleasure—what can be expected from the young but weakness—an officer, who was jealous because I often read the Lives of the Saints to the mistress of the house, suddenly came in unannounced. On that very evening I had been translating an episode of Judith into verse,
and was communicating it to the lady, who was paying me all sorts of compliments, and was leaning on my shoulder to read the verses over with me. The attitude, which was, I confess, rather free, offended the officer. He said nothing at the time, but when I went out, he followed me and overtook me. "Monsieur l'Abbé," said he, "do you like canings?" "I cannot tell, sir," said I, "no one having ever dared to give me any." "Well, then hear me, Monsieur l'Abbé. If you enter that house again, where I met you this evening, I will dare to do so." I believe I was afraid. I became very pale. I perceived that my legs failed me. I sought for some answer, but found none. So I kept silent. The officer waited for my answer, but finding that it did not come, he began to laugh, turned upon his heel, and re-entered the house. I returned to the seminary. "I am a gentleman born, and have a high spirit, as you have remarked, my dear D'Artagnan." The insult was terrible, and entirely unknown as it was to the rest of the world, I felt it living and moving at my very heart's core. I declared to my superior that I did not think myself sufficiently prepared for ordination, and at my request the ceremony was put off for a year. I sought out the best fencing master in Paris. I engaged him for one lesson every day, and every day throughout a whole year I took that lesson. Then, on the very anniversary of the day on which I had been insulted, I hung my cassock on a peg. I took the complete costume of a cavalier, and went to a ball given by a lady of my acquaintance, where I knew that I should find my man. It was in the Rue des France Bourgeois, very near La Force. My officer was indeed there. I went up to him as he was singing a love ditty, and looking tenderly at a lady, and I interrupted him in the very middle of the second verse. "Sir," said I, "are you still unwilling that I should enter a certain house in the Rue Payenne? And will you still give me a caning if I should take it into my head to disobey you?" The officer looked at me with astonishment, and then said, "What do you want, sir? I do not know you." "I am," said I, "the little abbé who was reading the lives of the saints, and who translated Judith into verse." Ah, I remember," said the officer merrily. "And what do you want?" "I would wish you to find leisure to take a walk with me." "Tomorrow, with great pleasure, if you really wish it." "No, not tomorrow, if you please, but immediately." "If you positively require it." "Yes, I do positively require it." "Come then, let us go," said he. "Ladies, do not disturb yourselves. Only give me time to kill this gentleman, and I will return and finish the second verse." We went out. I led him to the Rue Payenne, to the exact spot where, a year before, and exactly at the same hour, he had complimented me as I have related to you. The moonlight was superb. We drew our swords, and, at the first pass, I struck him dead. "The devil!" exclaimed D'Artagnan. Now, as the ladies did not perceive their singer return, and as he was found in the Rue Payenne with a frightful sword wound right through his body, it was thought that it was I who had so accommodated him, and the affair caused some scandal. I was, therefore, obliged for a time to give up the cassock. Athos, with whom I made acquaintance about that period, and Porthos, who had taught me, in addition to my fencing lessons, some merry thrusts, determined me on demanding the uniform of a musketeer. The king had loved my father, who was killed at the siege of Arras, and this uniform was granted to me. Now you will understand that the day is now arrived for my return into the bosom of the church. "And why today, more than yesterday or tomorrow? What has happened to you now to give you such miserable ideas?" "This wound, my dear D'Artagnan, has been to me a warning from heaven."
"This wound? It is almost healed. I am quite certain it is not that which causes the worst of your suffering."
"And what is it?" said Aramis, coloring.
"You have a deeper one in your heart, Aramis, one that bleeds more, a wound made by a woman."
The eye of Aramis sparkled involuntarily.
"Ah," said he, concealing his emotion under a feigned negligence, "do not speak of such things. Such thoughts are not for me, nor such solicitudes of love. Vanitas vanitatum. What, do you suppose then that my brain is turned? And for whom? Some pretty wench, some canon's daughter, to whom I might have paid my court in garrison? For shame! Pardon, my dear Aramis, but I thought that you carried your aim a little higher. Higher? And what am I, that I should have so much ambition? A poor musketeer, unprovided for and obscure, who hates servitude and feels himself an intruder in the turmoil of the world. Aramis! Aramis! Exclaimed D'Artagnan, looking on his friend with a glance of doubt. Dust, continued Aramis, I return to dust. Life is full of sorrow and humiliation, continued he, in deep affliction. All the threads which bind the woof of happiness break in our hands by turns. Fragile above all are the threads of gold. Oh, my dear D'Artagnan, added Aramis, infusing into his tone a slight degree of bitterness. Believe me, you must conceal carefully whatever wounds you have. Silence is the last enjoyment of the unfortunate. Let none know your grief. The curious would call up our tears, as insects suck the lifeblood of a wounded deer. Alas, my dear Aramis, said D'Artagnan, sighing deeply in his turn. It is my own history which you are unfolding. What? Yes, a woman whom I loved, whom I adored, has just been carried away by force. I know not where she is, where she has been taken to. Perhaps she is in prison, perhaps dead. But you at least have the consolation of knowing that she did not quit you voluntarily, and that if you do not hear from her, it is because communication is prevented, whilst... Whilst what? Nothing, replied Aramis. Nothing. Then you renounce the world forever? It is a settled choice, an irrevocable determination? Yes, forever. You are my friend today. Tomorrow you will be only as a shadow, or rather you will no longer exist for me. As for the world, it is at best no better than a sepulchre. The plague! This is all very lamentable. What would you desire? My vocation summons me. It impels me onwards. D'Artagnan smiled, but made no reply. Aramis continued, Nevertheless, whilst I am still belonging to the world, I would talk with you about yourself and our friends. And I, said D'Artagnan, would gladly have conferred with you about yourself, did I not see you so dissevered from all earthly things. At love you cry shame, friends are shadows, and the world itself is but a sepulchre. Alas, you will at last yourself find it so, exclaimed Aramis with a sigh. Let us waste no more words about that, said D'Artagnan, and let us burn this letter, which possibly announces to you some new infidelity of some pretty waiting maid. What letter? Eagerly cried Aramis. A letter which came to your lodgings during your absence, and which I have taken charge of. But from whom comes this letter? Perhaps from some disconsolate wench, some waiting maid of Madame de Chevreuse, possibly, who was obliged to return to Tours with her mistress, and who, to make herself gaudy, has provided perfumed paper and sealed the letter with a duchess's coronet. What are you telling me? I cannot surely have lost it, gravely remarked the young man, pretending to search for it. But happily the world is a sepulchre. The men, and consequently the women, are shadows, and love is a sentiment at which you cry shame. Ah, D'Artagnan, D'Artagnan, you kill me! Ejaculated Aramis. At last, here it is, said D'Artagnan, drawing the letter from his pocket. Aramis made a bound, seized the letter, and read, or rather devoured it, whilst his countenance gleamed with joy. The waiting maid seems to write in a good style, said the messenger carelessly. Thanks, D'Artagnan, exclaimed the almost delirious Aramis. She could not help it. She was compelled to return to Tours. She has not been unfaithful to me. She loves me still. Come, my friend, let me embrace you. My happiness suffocates me.
And the two friends began dancing round the folios of the venerable St. Chrysostom, treading gallantly on the leaves of the thesis which had fallen to the ground. At this moment Bazin entered with the spinach and the omelet. "Fly, wretch!" cried Aramis, throwing his skullcap at Bazin's head. "Return whence you came. Take away these horrible vegetables and those frightful eggs. Ask for a larded hare, a fat capon, a leg of mutton and garlic, and 4 bottles of old Burgundy." Bazin, who looked at his master and could make nothing of this change, let the omelet fall in his despair upon the spinach and the spinach upon the carpet. "Now is the time," said D'Artagnan, "to consecrate your existence to the King of Kings, if you desire to do him homage. Non inutile desirum in oblatione. Go to the devil with your Latin, my dear D'Artagnan. Let us drink. Egad, let us drink, and tell me a little of what has been going on in the world."
27. The Wife of Athos.
"Now we must obtain some intelligence of Athos," said D'Artagnan to the joyous Aramis, after he had told him everything that had happened since their departure from Paris, and after an excellent dinner had made the one forget his thesis and the other his fatigue. "Do you believe, then, that any misfortune has befallen him?" demanded Aramis. "Athos is so cool, so brave, and wields his sword so skilfully."
"Yes, doubtless, and no one knows better than I do the courage and address of Athos. But I like better the shock of lances on my sword than the blows of sticks, and I fear that Athos may have been beaten by the rabble who hit hard and do not leave off quickly. It is, I confess, on this account that I should like to set out as soon as possible."
"I will endeavour to accompany you," said Aramis, "although I am scarcely in a fit state to mount a horse. Yesterday I used the discipline which you see on the wall, but the pain made me give up that pious exercise."
"My dear friend, none ever heard of endeavouring to cure the wounds of a carbine by the strokes of a cat-o'-nine-tails. But you were ill, and as illness makes the head light, I excuse you."
"And when shall you set out?"
"Tomorrow, at break of day. Rest as well as you can tonight, and tomorrow, if you are able, we will go together."
"Farewell, then, till tomorrow," said Aramis, "for iron as you are, you must surely want some rest."
When D'Artagnan entered Aramis's room the next morning, he found him looking out of the window.
"What are you looking at?" said he.
"Faith, I am admiring those 3 magnificent horses which the stable boys are holding. It is a princely pleasure to travel on such animals."
"Well, then, my dear Aramis, you will give yourself that pleasure, for one of those horses belongs to you."
"Nonsense! And which?"
"Whichever you like, for I have no preference."
"And the rich caparison which covers him, is that also mine?"
"Certainly."
"You are laughing at me, D'Artagnan."
"I have left off laughing since you began to speak French again."
"And are those gilded holsters, that velvet housing, and that saddle, studded with silver, mine?"
"Yours, just as that horse which steps so proudly is mine, and that other one which caracoles so bravely is for Athos."
"If faith, they are superb animals."
"I'm glad that they suit your taste."
"Is it the king, then, who has made you this present?"
"You may be quite sure that it was not the cardinal. But do not disturb yourself as to whence they came. Only be satisfied that one of them is your own."
"I choose the one that the red-haired valet is holding."
"Well chosen."
"Thank God!" cried Aramis. "This drives away the last remnant of my pain. I would mount such a horse with 30 bullets in my body. Ah, upon my soul, what superb stirrups! Hello, Bazin, come here this instant."
Bazin appeared, silent and melancholy, at the door.
"Polish up my sword, smarten my hat, brush my cloak, and load my pistols," said Aramis.
"The last order is unnecessary," said D'Artagnan, "for there are loaded pistols in your holsters."
Bazin sighed deeply.
"Come, Master Bazin, console yourself," said D'Artagnan. "The kingdom of heaven may be gained in any condition of life." "But he was already such a good theologian," said Bazin, almost in tears. "He would have become a bishop,
perhaps even a cardinal.
Well, my poor Bazin, let us see and reflect a little. What is the use of being a churchman, pray? You do not by that means avoid going to war, for you see that the cardinal is about to make his first campaign with a headpiece on and a halberd in his hand. And Monsieur de Nogaret de la Valette, what do you say to him? He is a cardinal too, and ask his lackey how often he has made lint for him.
Alas, sighed Bazin, I know it, sir. The whole world is turned topsy-turvy nowadays.
During this talk, the two young men and the poor lackey had gone downstairs.
Hold my stirrup for me, Bazin, said Aramis.
Aramis sprang into his saddle with his accustomed grace and activity. But after some curvets and capers of the noble animal, the rider felt his pain so utterly insupportable that he grew pale and wavered in his seat. D'Artagnan, who, foreseeing such a misfortune, had kept his eye upon him, rushed towards him, caught him in his arms, and led him back again to his room.
"Never mind, my dear Aramis," said he. "Take care of yourself. I will go alone in search of Athos."
"You are a man of steel," said Aramis.
"No," replied he. "I am fortunate, that is all. But what will you do whilst I am absent? No more theses, no more arguments on hands, no benedictions, eh?"
Aramis smiled.
"No, I shall make verses," said he. "Yes, verses with the same perfume as the note of Madame de Chevreuse's waiting maid. Teach Bazin prosody. That will fill him with delight. And, as for the horse, ride him for a little while every day, and that will make you accustomed to the work."
"Oh, as for that, be satisfied that you shall find me ready to follow you." They bade each other adieu, and in a few minutes D'Artagnan, having commended his friend to the care of Bazin and the landlady, was trotting onwards on his way toward Amiens. And in what condition should he find Athos? Should he even find him at all? The position in which he had left him was critical, and it was not improbable that Athos might have been destroyed. This idea clouded the brow of D'Artagnan, and made him mutter many a vow of vengeance. Of all his friends, Athos was the eldest, and apparently the least akin to him in sympathies and tastes, and yet he had a marked preference for this gentleman. The noble and distinguished air of Athos, those flashes of dignity which from time to time shone forth from the cloud in which he had voluntarily enveloped himself, that unalterable equanimity of temper which made him the best companion in the world, that forced yet ironic gaiety, that courage which would have been denominated blind had it not been the result of the rarest coolness, so many excellent qualities attracted more than the esteem, more even than the friendship of D'Artagnan. They attracted his admiration. In fact, by the side even of the elegant and noble courtier Monsieur de Treville, Athos, in his bright days, might advantageously sustain comparison. He was of only medium height, but his figure was so admirably formed and proportioned that more than once, in his sportive contests with Porthos, he had subdued the giant, whose physical power had become proverbial amongst the musketeers. His countenance, with its piercing eyes and aquiline nose, and a chin chiselled like that of Brutus, had an indescribable character of dignity and grace. His hands, of which he took no care, were the despair of Aramis, who cherished his at a great expense of almond paste and perfumed oil. The sound of his voice was penetrating and, at the same time, melodious. And then, a something altogether indefinable in Athos, who shrunk from all display, there was a delicate knowledge of the world, and of the customs of the most brilliant society, that was perceptible, apparently without his being conscious of it, in all his minutest actions. If a banquet was to be prepared, Athos could preside better than anybody else, placing every guest in the precise rank and station to which his ancestry or his own achievements had entitled him. If heraldic science was required, Athos knew all the noble families in the kingdom, their genealogies, their alliances, their arms, and the origin of their arms. Etiquette had no minutiae with which he was not well acquainted. He knew the various rights of the great landowners, and so thoroughly understood hunting and falconry, that one day, in talking of that art, he had astonished the king himself, who was a past master of it. Like all the noblemen of the time, he rode and fenced to perfection. And more than that, his education had been so well attended to, even on scholastic points, which were rarely introduced amongst gentlemen of that age, that he smiled at the scraps of Latin which Aramis let fall, and which Porthos pretended to understand. And two or three times, even, to the great astonishment of his friends, when Aramis had made some mistake in the rudiments, Athos had put a verb into its proper tense, or a noun into its case. Besides all this, his probity was unimpeachable. At a time when military men made so light of their religion and conscience, lovers of the rigorous delicacy of our own days, and the poor of the seventh commandment of their God. Athos was, therefore, a very extraordinary man. And yet this nature so distinguished, this creature so beautiful, this essence so fine, was seen to turn insensibly towards a material life, as old men often tend to physical and moral imbecility. In his hours of privation, and these were frequent, Athos was extinguished as respected all his luminous nature, and all his brilliant qualities disappeared as in a dark night. Then, in place of the vanished demigod, there remained scarcely a human being. His head drooped, his eye was dull, his voice heavy and languid, and he would look for hours at nothing but his bottle and his glass, or at Grimaud, who, accustomed to obey him by signs, read in his look the smallest wish, which he immediately gratified. If the four friends met by chance during one of these intervals, a word, escaping as if by a violent effort, was all that Athos could contribute to the conversation. But to compensate for this deficiency, Athos alone drank as much as all the rest, without any other apparent effect than a more manifest contraction of the eyebrows and a more profound melancholy. D'Artagnan, with whose inquisitive and penetrating mind we are already acquainted, whatever motive he might have for indulging his curiosity on the subject, had been unable hitherto to assign any cause for this melancholy, or for its frequent recurrence.
This is the end of disc number 9. Please insert disc number 10. This is disc number 10.
D'Artagnan, with whose inquisitive and penetrating mind we are already acquainted, whatever motive he might have for indulging his curiosity on the subject, had been unable hitherto to assign any cause for this melancholy, or for its frequent recurrence. Athos never received any letters, and never did anything which was not known to his three friends. It could not be said that this sadness was a result of wine, for, on the contrary, he only drank in the hope of conquering that which this remedy did really increase. His despondency could not be attributed to play, for, unlike Porthos, who indicated by songs and oaths all the fluctuations of fortune, Athos maintained the same impassibility, whether he had won or lost. In the circle of the musketeers, he had been seen to win 3,000 pistoles in an evening, and to lose them again, as well as his horse, his arms, or even his gold-embroidered gala belt, and to win back the whole of these, and 100 louis over, without his handsome black eyebrow having been depressed or raised by a hair's breadth, without his hand having lost its pearly hue, and without his conversation, which was on that particular evening cheerful, having ceased for one instant to be agreeable and calm. Nor was it, as in the case of our neighbours the English, an atmospheric influence which clouded over his countenance. For this sadness became more intense in the most brilliant seasons of the year. June and July were the bad months of Athos. It was not about the present that he grieved, and he shrugged his shoulders when anyone spoke to him of the future. His secret sorrow, then, had reference to the past, as had been vaguely told to D'Artagnan. The mysterious complexion which was thus spread over him only rendered more interesting the man who, neither by his eyes nor tongue, had ever, even in the most complete intoxication, revealed anything to the most skilfully conducted investigation.
"Well," mused D'Artagnan, "poor Athos may perhaps be now dead, and dead through my fault, for it was I who drew him into this affair, of which he knew neither the origin nor aim, and from which he could expect no benefit."
"Without reckoning, sir," said Planchet, "that we probably owe our lives to him. You remember how he cried out, 'Away, D'Artagnan, I am seized!' And after having discharged his two pistols, what a terrible noise he made with his sword! One would have believed there were 20 men, or rather 20 mad devils."
These words redoubled D'Artagnan's eagerness. He urged forward his horse, which, needing no urging, carried him on at a gallop. Towards 11 in the morning they caught sight of Amiens, and at 11:30 they were at the door of the fatal inn. D'Artagnan had often meditated against the treacherous host one of those genuine acts of vengeance which give no satisfaction except in the anticipation. He entered the hotel with his hat over his eyes, his left hand on the hilt of his sword, making his riding whip whistle with his right.
"Do you know me?" said he to the landlord, who came forward to welcome him.
"I have not that honour, sir," replied the latter,
his eyes dazzled by the splendid equipage with which D'Artagnan presented himself.
"Ah, you do not recognise me?"
"No, sir."
"Well, then, two words will restore your recollection. What have you done with that gentleman against whom you had the audacity about a fortnight ago to bring an accusation of passing bad money?"
The host turned pale, for D'Artagnan had assumed a most threatening attitude, and Planchet closely followed his master's example.
"Ah, sir, do not mention that," replied the host in a most lamentable tone of voice. "Ah, sir, how dearly have I paid for that fault! Alas, unfortunate has been my fate!"
"This gentleman, I ask, what has become of him?"
"Only deign to hear me, sir, and be merciful. Be seated, I beseech you."
D'Artagnan, dumb from anger and anxiety, sat down, stern as a judge, and Planchet finally established himself behind his chair.
"This is the statement, sir," said the trembling landlord, "for now I recognize you. It was you who went away when I had that unhappy dispute with the gentleman of whom you speak."
"Yes, it was I. So you see that you have no mercy to expect if you do not tell the whole truth."
"Condescend to listen, sir, and you shall hear everything."
"I hear you."
"I had been informed by the authorities that a celebrated coiner would arrive at my hotel, with several of his companions, all disguised under the uniform of guards or musketeers. Your horses, your servants, your features, gentlemen, were all exactly described."
"What next? What next?" cried D'Artagnan,
who soon discerned the source of this precise description.
"Therefore, under the direction of the authorities, who sent me a reinforcement of 6 men, I took such measures as I considered indispensable to secure the persons of these alleged coiners."
"Well," said D'Artagnan, whose ears were terribly wounded by this term, coiners.
"Forgive me, sir, for speaking of such things, but they are truly my excuse. The authorities had frightened me, and you know that an innkeeper must respect the authorities."
"But once more, where is this gentleman? What has become of him? Is he dead or is he alive?"
"Patience, sir. We have just come to that. Well, sir, you know what happened, and your hasty departure," added the innkeeper, with a cunning which did not escape D'Artagnan, "seemed to justify my proceedings. The gentleman, your friend, defended himself desperately. His servant had, unfortunately, sought an unexpected quarrel with the officers of justice, who were disguised as stable boys."
"Ah, the wretches!" cried D'Artagnan. "You were all in the plot, and I know not why I should not exterminate you all. "Alas, no, sir. We were not all agreed, as you will soon perceive. The gentleman, your friend, pardon me for not giving him the honourable name which no doubt he bears, but we do not know that name. The gentleman, your friend, after having disabled two men by his pistol shots, beat a retreat.